Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
The maker movement. You've probably heard the term, but it's not easy to characterize. I guess I would say it contains a number of these communal workspaces that are equipped with a bunch of fancy equipment for like things like manufacturing prototypes that are like the equipment's way too expensive for people to afford as individuals. And there are people, sometimes with their kids, they're there trying to create some cool new thing. I think of 3D manufacturing as one of the, you know, is what they tend to do a lot of. Well, but where is the maker movement on the continuum from a playground for the former Tinker Toy set to, on the other end of the continuum, an incubator for sustainable income? With me to address that question and the whole question of the maker movement is a guy named David Lang. He is the maker of a low-cost underwater robot. He is a 2013 TED Fellow. Means he's going to talk at TED, which is very cool. And he's contributing editor to Make Magazine and is the author of a new book, whose cover I think is great, called Zero to Maker. Learn just enough to make just about anything. David Lang, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, it's great to be here.
Good. Well, first things first, what is the... My definition was probably really botched up. What's the maker movement?
You know, this is actually a really good question, is how do you define maker? You know, what is the maker movement? And I think a lot of people, even us who are in this world, have a tough time defining it. And it's a really big tent. And I think it encompasses all of these different people, you know, garage manufacturers, people who are into sewing and crafts, people are into new digital fabrication tools. Anyone who kind of sees the physical world is something that they can manipulate, that they can alter and change for whatever they want.
So how is it different from the do-it-yourself, you know, do-it-yourselfers who've been around since the Stone Age?
Oh, I think it's very, very related to the do-it-yourselfers. I think it's a direct line. I mean, we're right in that lineage. The big difference here is the internet. You know, I talk about this a lot in the book, is that this new maker movement is 50% building and then 50% sharing. So it's, you know, taking that spirit of making something, that magic of building your own stuff, and timesing that by the internet.
It seems to me what's different is, this may sound weird, but it strikes me that the maker movement is more of an offshoot of BitTorrent, file sharing, screw the corporation, let's collaborate together and see if we can beat the corporation. There's a very lefty communal feel to it that, and you know, everything is open source, we share, we don't patent stuff as much, we share more, it's more like Wikipedia, the commons agreements. Is that right?
You know, I don't know if it's kind of a lefty communal thing. I think those attributes that you cited are definitely accurate. I mean, we do share all of our designs, and we encourage everyone to share what they're working on OpenROV. But the reason we do that is because it's effective, because we can. I think, you know, Wikipedia wasn't possible, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And we're in this situation now where all of a sudden we can start building underwater robots in our garage. And we're going to do it.
Then sharing is real fun, and it probably does create a better product, but does it create unemployment, essentially? Because if you're giving everything away to everybody, and you're expecting everybody else to volunteer their time and share not their time and their intellectual property, the things they invented, their machines, what everything, is that not a form? Does that argue that, in fact, that maker movement is, you know, much more of a hobbyist group and much more of a, you know, a very seductive attraction which keeps you from making money in the same way as acting and performing and art? Only 1 out of 1,000 people make a living with art, but we're all totally seduced by it, and so we spend a lot of time doing it. Is it possible that the maker movement is the equivalent of the starving artists, the millions of starving artists who have their little workshops and lose money on it?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because at the very, very heart of this is learning, is learning new skills. And, you know, for an example, I lost my job. I was working for a company that ended up running out of money, and I was one of those people who write emails all day, and I was out of a job 3 years ago. And it was a shock to me. It really just, my whole system, my whole story for who I was and what I did in the world was gone. And I spent, you know, a few days just kind of wandering around Los Angeles, going for long walks. And I ran into this carpenter and had this great conversation with him about, you know, his craft. And I realized that was something that you couldn't take away from him. That was something that, you know, no matter if you know, he didn't have a job, you couldn't take this skill away from him. And I knew that I wanted that. And I think that's what I went after. And I found the employment afterwards. And, you know, even if, you know, the underwater robots went away, I would just start making something else.
Have you, you know, you're a success story. I mean, you're a contributing editor to Make Magazine. You wrote the book, you know, Zero to Maker. you know, if you added all of the costs to making that underwater robot, the costs that you put in, the cost of volunteer time of others put in, et cetera, how long has it taken you, and what is your net profit and loss for that underwater robot?
Okay, so this is interesting. When I lost my job, I'd say I probably had about $5,000 in savings. So I had a little bit of money saved up, and I just was going to dedicate my next 3 months to learning how to make stuff. This would be for underwater robots. And so I came back to San Francisco and started taking classes at this facility called Tech Shop. And so my living expenses burned up pretty quickly, but I was just getting so much out of making stuff. Instead of just sitting around and applying for jobs all day, I was actually, you know, I could go to this workshop and see something that I created, which was really important for my confidence and my self-esteem at the time. But I spent all of that money. We had prototyped several of the robots. So, you know, my money went into it. And then my business partner, Eric Stackpole, his money had gone into it. But, you know, by and large, we had access to millions of dollars of tooling and equipment at Tech Shop. And the membership there is, you know, $120 a month now. But it's fairly accessible. And we got to the point where we needed more money and we wanted to make more kits of our robot. We wanted to get more people involved. So we put it on Kickstarter, and that doesn't cost anything. We wanted to raise $20,000, and we ended up raising that in 2 hours, and we raised $100,000 after that. And, you know, we had a profitable first year of our business, and, you know, it's continuing to grow from there.
My question is net-net. How in the investors count to their money count. I'm trying to see, is this a profitable enterprise? So I'm saying, yeah. Count up all the hours you spent,
sure.
All the money you invested, all the money your investors invested.
Yeah.
Think of the sale, the net, not only the top-line sales of your robot, but, you know, what is the bottom line? How much time, how much money, and has it been a net profit or net loss? And how much of both?
Wow, man, this is a really, really tough question. So we did raise money for our company. We raised $1.3 million earlier this year, but that's because we want to invest in some specific things to grow with. Listen, I'm not getting rich. That I'm very open about that. I'm not making a lot of money, but I am having a lot of fun. And to look back on how far, you know, I've come from in 2 years. I mean, literally 2 years ago, I didn't have a job. I didn't think that I had these skills. And I felt really, really alone and really scared.
I got the fun component. That's clear. But it's feeling like school. It's feeling more like, not that it's that the maker movement is a model for making money, but a model for training that's more aligned with an apprenticeship program where someone, we'll talk about this, where who's paying for these millions of dollars of equipment. Mm-hmm. So is it right that really the maker movement needs to be seen as more of a, like an alternative to school, an alternative to career tech programs at colleges? Is that a fair statement, a way to describe what the maker movement really functionally is?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, I brought this up the other day with someone. I said it's kind of like this bizarro Ponzi scheme almost, where in order for it to keep going, you need more makers involved. And that's the only way that this keeps get going. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that is everyone walks away with more skills.
Yep, yep, it's true.
And everyone walks away with this feeling. I mean, you get this feeling as soon as you go to Maker Faire, you come to our offices, you meet with our community, you meet, you know, any of these makers, and there's a sense of belonging, a sense of meaning. And I think that's what's missing in so many people's jobs is the meaning.
So I think, though, that we need what we're comparing, it should not be jobs, it's school. Most people come away from school with a lot of debt, a lot of learning theory that doesn't apply, mm-hmm. and most people don't find it fun. They're learning, you know, if you want to be an engineer, you're taking all this physics, this abstract physics and calculus and all this stuff, whereas you guys are getting together and building cool state-of-the-art things with millions of dollars. So it's like, it's more like an apprenticeship. It's an alternative to school rather than an alternative to making a living. It's a training ground, which you then can use those skills later to get hired by somebody or start a business, but it's it's an alternative to school. Is that accurate?
I think absolutely, it's accurate. So when I lost my job, I started thinking about, okay, what do I really want to do? I wished that I was an industrial designer, but I didn't have any money. I couldn't mm-hmm. go back to school. So mm-hmm. I concocted mm-hmm. this whole scheme. All right, if I was going to become a DIY industrial designer, how would I do that?
Right.
And that's what led to this whole
exactly.
book.
Exactly, got it.
And I think it is absolutely about learning.
Yeah.
But it's also about finding meaning, you know? I think that, you know, it's, there's so many possibilities. It's almost like you've kicked the door open to this new world of possibility.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is David Lang, one of the pillars of, if I may say so, of the maker movement. Among his many accomplishments is a book that just came out called, and he writes very well, it's called Zero to Maker, Learn Just Enough to Make Just About Anything. We keep talking about these millions of dollars of equipment, and some mm-hmm. of it is you raise for your because mm-hmm. you have some equipment you want of your own, if you will.
Right.
But the prototypical maker mm-hmm. goes to one of these workshops, like you said, the tech shop, and has got millions of dollars of equipment there. Who pays for that millions of dollars of equipment?
Let's talk about these in more detail, because these are a big deal. These things are called maker spaces.
Great.
And they come in all shapes and sizes. There's little co-op locations, like there's a place called Noise Bridge in San Francisco that's fantastic. And there's this big commercial operations like Tech Shop, which is almost like a fitness club for makers. You know, they have millions of dollars of equipment. You pay a monthly fee. But these locations, you know, if you want to talk about the maker movement as a form of education, these are the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's a tough business model. It's not a great scalable business, as a lot of these these maker spaces are finding out. But there's a lot of magic happening there. And I think there's this whole maker infrastructure that's coming together. There's websites, there's these actual locations. But you can actually just go and show up to these places, and you'll find that these people are welcoming.
Right.
Even if you don't have any skills, there are people who are there to teach you. And that's really a hallmark of this maker movement. When I got started, I was scared. I was nervous that I was admitting that I didn't know how to do this. And what I found was this community who was really willing to teach.
Sounds like incredibly valuable for the maker. The question is, pardon the pun, is it sustainable? If, in fact, it's a shaky business model where you're spending millions of dollars on equipment and expensive San Francisco real mm-hmm. estate, mm-hmm. And people are not paying that much to be mm-hmm. able to get in and use it, will it ultimately just fade away because it's just not capitalized enough? And volunteerism is fabulous, but there are organizations that are pure volunteer have mm-hmm. a hard time staying alive for a long time, like the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
It was not capitalized. It was a bunch of angry people who were very, very passionate about mm-hmm. something, but it wasn't fundable, and so it's been kind of dissipating away. Is this sustainable without having, you know, money, real serious money behind it?
I think absolutely. And I think that because there's not real big money behind it, because we're being forced to do this, you know, ad hoc, because we didn't have anything else, we just started building stuff in our garage. We started where we were. And I think that's exactly the reason that this kind of thing is sustainable, is because there's not going to be, it's tough to say how it shakes out. But I think the reason that it's sustainable is because of the fundamental changes that happen with people when they get involved. I mean, I have this book. I'm a little bit more visible, but I am not alone. You know, there's a whole community and group of people all over the country and all over the world who are finding this community and seeing all these different possibilities. And I think it changes you. I mean, more than all these tools it changes you to see the world as malleable.
Much
as
more than school. School is supposed to, in its theory, in all the brochures, you know, they talk about school being transformative, but it's rarely transformative. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the maker movement and these workspaces and the collaborations and the individual work is much more likely to be transformative of a human being.
You know, for me it was.
Yeah.
You know, I went to school and I went to college and I studied business and I thought I was doing the right thing and I went and got a job and I thought I was, you know, on track. And it wasn't until I lost that, you know, I got kind of derailed from that, that I realized, you know, I haven't learned anything.
Yeah, I understand. You know, how many people come away feeling like the term the imposter syndrome comes from universities bestowing these pieces of paper saying you are an expert at something. You've got a bachelor's degree in economics or a master's degree in physics or a PhD in molecular biology. In the end, you feel like you don't know a lot of crap because don't know much because you've been taught all this theory. What kind of things actually get made at these maker workspaces?
So that's a good question. There's a lot, you know, we can talk a little bit about these tools because you brought up 3D manufacturing.
Right.
And there's actually this whole suite of digital fabrication tools that have come online. And there's, you know, some of them are 3D printers. A lot of, you know, there's a lot of laser cutters. So it's a computer controlled machine that uses a laser to cut out different parts. That's what we use for our underwater robot. Our CNC machines, so computer controlled machines, CAD design. This is all, it allows you to make stuff digitally, which is something a lot of people have become familiar with, is digital tools, and make those real. And it also allows you to make a lot of them. So, you know, I think that these tools are really, really powerful. And you ask what is made. I mean, I've seen everything from a lot of people are making 3D printers and a lot of people are making, you know, underwater robots and drones and anything that, you know, has like electronics because, you know, all the things that are going into your smartphones are making electronics much more accessible. And then there's people just making crafts.
Let's get specific. Yeah. Let's start. You were fired from or let go from your job. And then let's walk me through the first moment you decided to make something, to how you decided it was going to be this underwater robot, to what you actually did, the machines you used, where you got stuck. Walk me through the whole process so people can get a feel for how the maker movement contributed to your metamorphosis, if you will.
Sure. So, you know, it actually happened before I lost my job. The true story is that I went to a maker fair here in San Mateo, and now these maker fairs are happening all over the country. You can go to makerfair.com and there's probably going to be one in your area in the very near future. But I showed up at one of these places and I was blown away. One of my friends had told me to go. They said, you should go and check out this maker fair. And I said, what is that? What's going on there? And they said, you just have to go and see it. And I did. And they were right. It was one of those things that you just have to see.
What blew you away?
Well, you know, there's robots wandering around in the crowds. There's drones flying above overhead. There's 3D printers making stuff on demand. But the most important thing, the thing that stuck out the most, was the people on the other side of these tables and the passion that they had for what they were building. It was like nothing I had seen. You know, I, you know, had a job and people kind of go through their world and, you know, they just show up. But these people were so excited.
Before we go forward with the development of your underwater robot, there is something that feels vaguely elitist about it, ironically, and I'll tell you why.
Uh-huh.
For somebody to, I mean, I am retarded at building anything.
Uh-huh.
You could take me to 10 maker fairs and have all the welcoming people and $10 billion of equipment, and I ain't going to make squat. Yeah. I am just retarded at visualizing building whatever.
Yeah.
You need a certain kind of genius almost to create, I mean, anybody can create a piece of crap, but something really good. Is this really for truly kind of really creative, excellent engineering, you know, 3D visualization types and not everybody else?
That's exactly what I thought when I showed up at that first maker fair. I said, wow, these people are so passionate and excited, but I can't do this. You know, I have a job. I have to go back and write emails. And these people are all geniuses. You know, they have these elaborate garage, you know, workshops. They're mad scientists, you know, creating these things. And it wasn't until I kind of finally made that commitment, I didn't have the job and said, I'm going to do this, that I realized that that's not the case at all. Is that these people, no one's making anything themselves, by the way. This whole DIY, do-it-yourself, big misnomer. Because everything that's happening here is being done together. And Eric and I found this out very early when we started making underwater robots, is we didn't know very much. And what we did was we created this website and asked other people to help. and it became this big team effort.
Huh.
And I think that's what you find is that you do have a lot of skills. You know, you're a great communicator, and that's really important in the maker movement, to document it, to tell the story of what you guys are making. There's certainly a project you could contribute to. And, you know, there's so many things that people don't realize that they're good at that kind of come out in this process of joining this movement, because they realize that, oh, we're talking about what's possible, not what I've already done or what, you know, my resume says I can do. We're just talking about what we can make together in the future.
So how in the world did you come up with the idea of underwater robot? Of all the things in the world, where did that come from?
Well, I didn't come up with the idea, to be honest. This guy, Eric Stackpole. So I'd showed up at this maker fair and I wanted to get involved. And one of the guys there said, hey, I know this guy who's building a robot in his garage. I think you'd like to meet him. I said, I would love to meet him. And so I met this guy, Eric Stackpole, and he told me this fantastic story about this underwater cave in Northern California. And there was rumors of gold and a robbery in the gold rush, and no one had been to the bottom. And he said, and I want to build an underwater robot to go explore. And I was in. I was hooked. I said, you got to let me help you. And I didn't have any skills at the time, so I said, well, I'll help you build a website. I see a lot of these other maker groups are, you know, doing these open source projects, and it seems to work. You got to let me tag along. And he said, okay, sure. And so we came up with this name, OpenROV, and, you know, the rest is history. You know, actually, I shouldn't say that. The rest was not history.
Right.
Because there was many months right. where it was just Eric and I on the forums talking back and forth to each other. And we just kept showing up every day and showing how far we'd come and what we needed help with and asking people.
Walk me through the steps. What happened? So I have the idea. All I'm picturing is you got this idea. You're going to collaborate. You create this website. And now you've got these places, these tech shops with all these machines and these people willing to help. Walk me through the key steps of what happened, you know, between then and the end of the thing.
Well, so like I said, we started this website, openrov.com. We had a name and we said, we're going to do this. We're going to build an underwater robot and we're going to go explore this cave. That's it. And then we started a forum, and basically it was me asking Eric a lot of physics questions and him answering them and me doing research on that stuff. And, you know, we kept showing up. We showed up at maker fairs. We'd show up at these maker spaces and show what we had, which was really just some plastic that we had cut out and some electronics that we were trying to get together. I mean, a lot of the technology in our robot didn't come about until midway through our project. So we started building this before the technology that enabled it even existed.
I can understand about cutting out pieces of plastic, but you just blithely threw out the term some electronics. I mean, that feels like completely daunting to me. How did you figure out what electronics, how to get it made, what to get off the shelf? How did you go do all that electronic stuff?
Yeah, you know what? And it's still intimidating for me. Electronics in general is a really tricky concept. I mean, people go to school for 10 years studying electrical
right.
engineering to make this stuff work. But, you know, the interesting thing now is that some of these groups, like these Arduino microcontrollers. So, you know, we're surrounded by all this stuff that has these electronics in them. You know, phones and computers and toasters and all these different things have, you know, some form of electronics. And it's amazing that we don't know how more of that works. I mean, I grew up in this world where everything was kind of done for you. You know, you get advertisements that tell you to buy these products. If it breaks, you get it fixed or you get a new one. But you just start tinkering with these things and you realize that's how a lot of these things work. And there's platforms like Arduino and Raspberry Pi that are trying to make these small miniature computers or little microcontrollers that you can actually tinker with and you can make stuff.
Let's drill down. I did read the part of your book which talks about how you went into the cave with this thing.
Yeah.
So the robot has got to be able to be, you know, go take steps down. It's
yeah.
got to move in certain ways. How did you get the legs of the thing to go down in irregular circumstances? What electronics? How did you know what electronics are needed? This just feels like an impossibility to Marty Nemco. How do you
sure,
do that?
Sure. Yeah. So let's be honest. The first one, the electronics didn't work. The first one, the robot sank to the bottom of the pool. You know, there was a lot of mistakes that we made and a lot of failure. And this was one of the things that came up is for me, those were devastating failures. But for Eric and for other makers I met, they pull this robot out and they go, oh my gosh, look at how much we learned. You know, there's all these different things. But there's a first step for electronics, and it's called the Arduino platform. And it's a little, they make these little boards, and it's very, very easy to pick up one of these Arduino boards and learn how to start programming physical stuff. And what that means is that you can write code for the Arduino and then start controlling lights and actuators and motors and different things like that. And it's you know, Google Arduino and you'll find ways to get involved.
You're making write code sound like any idiot like me could do this. I mean, just write some code that helps, you know, using this platform Arduino. I mean, it doesn't feel like it's for normal people. It's like for geniuses.
So you know, this is one of those things that you got to understand is there's the tool, but then there's the community of people behind the tool. And so the Arduino forums, if you go to arduino.com, you can see that they've created these vast libraries of programs that you could just say, oh, I want the blinky light program, and I just go and download that, or I click on that. And, oh, I don't know how to make this do this. Well, I'll just ask a question on the forums, and someone will answer me in 5 minutes.
Got it.
And you really got to – the thing about the maker movement is it's not the tools. It's not the tools. It's the mindset that I can do this. I can make this. And yeah, I'm not going to know how to do this, but I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to find the people who do know how to do it, and we're going to make it together.
So let's move prospectively. Let's say we have some listeners who are saying, you know, I've got some time on my hands. I'm one of the millions of people who are underemployed or, you know, and I like the idea of creating something. I like doing it collaboratively, getting answers to everything. I don't know squat. I'm a reasonably bright, motivated person, but I don't know squat about all this stuff. Today, with lessons you've learned, not only from your own experience, but in reading Make Magazine, you know, which is the industry, the gold standard publication in the field. If, let's say, Marty Nemko, and I was completely candid about my, you know, I guess I'm a communicator too, but I am retarded at building anything. But let's say I have an idea. Oh, let me do that. I'm going to share my favorite building idea.
All right. Let's
and you
talk
tell
about
me
it.
What you do. Okay. Old people. My mom is old.
Okay.
And she falls, and she has a caretaker, but it would be great if she could be able to have this little robot that she could slide under her butt and push a button, and it lifts her up, because many old people can't get up when they fall. They have a hard time getting up. So I want to create this little robot that basically is a flat piece of metal that she gets her, slides her butt under, and it's got a little scissor raising thing, like
kind of like you'd jack up your car to change a tire,
right? Something like that, right? And that it would, you know, she'd push a button, and it would raise her up so that she can stand up. Now that's my little, that's my vision, that's my dream idea.
Sure.
And I like the idea of not having to, you know, I'd like to, creating it myself with a team of, you know, all kinds of people, because I don't know squat about anything other than communication. What should I do, given what you've known, what you now know about the maker movement, about how to make that happen?
Okay. So first step. I have no idea how to do that.
Right.
let's start there. Second thing, all right, let's figure out where we can find people who know how to do this stuff.
Good.
Let's show up at Tech Shop and ask one of these dream coaches there to, you know, how would they start this? Let's go online, check the forum, see if there is a pick-me-up machine that already exists, or a forum or a community that is already talking about this. You know, you start there. You start with, okay, I don't know everything. That's great. You know, this means I have this opportunity to learn how to do this. And, you know, the share first and share often is what I always say, is share what you're trying to do and bring as many people in as you can. So, for example, my mom, also, who I think is listening, she wanted, you know, she said the same thing. David, I'm not a maker. I can't do this. And I said, okay. You know, I get that. What do you want to make? And she said, well, I really want to, you know, build this brush, like an SOS pad that's kind of like a Sonicare toothbrush that automatically, you know, vibrates and gets the grime away. I said, okay, well, let's make it. Let's start making it. So we disassembled, you know, this was one Saturday morning. We disassembled the Sonicare toothbrush, put an SOS pad on it, and started prototyping and seeing if we could get something to work. And then we went and shared our photos and our drawings and our ideas on quirky.com, which is one of these websites. I list a bunch of these places, these great places to share online. And we put it up, and within hours, we had people commenting on it, giving us ideas of how we could change it and alter it. And, you know, it's just, she just realized that this is a feedback loop. And I think that's the power here, is that it's not something you're doing alone. You know, there are people who are enabling this and enabling you to make whatever you can dream of.
I think I want to enable one or two of our listeners to get the wisdom of David Lang on this. So if you are somebody who is either a maker and want to share your story, or you've got a question or a problem related to the idea of you'd like to make something, I invite you to give a call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, and my guest, David Lang, who is the author of Zero to Maker, Learn Just Enough to Make Just About Anything. The phone number, 415-841-4134. And we already have callers on the line, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment for David Lang?
Hi. Is that me?
It is.
Okay. I just want to say I have been to a maker place in Oakland, and I really want to support you guys in what you're doing. And I found it also to be very amazing and empowering, especially as a woman coming to a place that was predominantly men. That I think what you're doing is a really interesting reconceptualization of both what is valued economically in the society and also how knowledge is shared. And, you know, when Marty was asking, well, how do you make money out of this? You know, I think that the maker movement is partly reconceptualizing a different economy, but also a different way of transmitting knowledge. You know, people, and also, as you say, empowering people. Like, you know, people say when you go to school, you can sing, you can dance. When you leave school, you can't do either. So, you know, these are somewhat of the innate skills that people have: curiosity, working together, and creating things. Kind of the way Steve Jobs started, or should I say, the person who really made the computer, his friend,
Steve Wozniak. Yeah.
And
you know, our underwater robot.
And if instead they, and with a bunch of other people, but instead if they had shared all that knowledge with each other, and one person making all the money, it was had been, you know, shared with everybody, it would have been a different model. So I think that this maker movement is part of that reconceptualizing. How do we make things? How do we value things? How do we create a different economic system that wherein everybody is becoming empowered to had that curiosity to make things, to think outside the box.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the call. I mean, that's where we come back to that whole, it is a very lefty concept where there, you know, it is shared ownership, it's collaborative, it's very communal. It's not about individual profit, it's about really, it does harken back to socialism, you know, more to communism, where there's, you know, there's just really shared ownership. There is no individual property. Is that fair?
Maybe. It's kind of true, but it's also, you know, what Apple does is amazing. They make these iPhones that are, you know, just incredible pieces of technology, and they ship these things all over the world. That is something amazing that they have a great system that does that.
But that is completely proprietary. They patent every damn thing, and they sue Samsung as soon as Samsung comes even close to, you know, it's completely opposite of what the caller was saying about everything is shared. The question is, you know, it's really nice to not be too materialistic, but can you pay for your home and your health insurance and your food and your transportation, even your BART fare if you're not owning a car?
Yeah.
That's the question. Is this a path to even marginal sustainable employability is my question for many, for a significant percentage of the people.
And that's important, and I think that relates to this Apple idea, because mass manufacturing is not going away.
Right.
This is just enabling a lot more. And what I think that does is it's going to be blurry. You know, some people will pick up these maker skills on the side, and some people will, you know, show up at a makerspace and have one idea that they really want to get going. And this happens all the time at Tech Shop. People will show up, have a couple ideas that don't get off the ground, but then they start teaching classes.
Yeah. I am stuck on the idea that this is not an alternative employment model. This is an alternative training model. Who will go away in from some of this is the college-based training programs for people who would be inventors, engineering types. Mm-hmm. Then it doesn't have to be a source of sustainable income, because some people are going to end up getting employed by companies. Others are going to be self-employed. Mm-hmm. I think it's a training vehicle. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to work. And do you agree? We see you agreed earlier. Sorry.
I do, but I've also seen a lot of people make good money and now have new lives because of this.
Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. My special guest, David Lang, the author of Zero to Maker, all about the maker movement. What's your comment or question for him?
Hi, David. So when you have your company set up this website, and you asked for help from the community to pitch in ideas to further develop your underwater robot, and so do those contributors to your idea, do they know that you're going to be profiting from their from their input, and that's okay with everyone?
This is a good question. So Eric and I are on a mission, and we want everyone in the world to be able to explore. We think that the tools for exploration should be available to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our number one goal. And the reason we make money is so we can do more of that. And everyone in our community knows Eric and I are in it for those reasons. And, you know, I think we've just been really clear about what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so to give you an example, National Geographic called us the other day and said, hey, we're going to these caves in the Yucatan in Mexico, and we want you to come with one of your robots to, you know, help us explore these caves. And Eric and I both were busy. We couldn't go. But one of the guys in our community ended up flying down there and going hiking through with National Geographic through the jungle and exploring these caves and finding these old Mayan artifacts. It was really spectacular. But when Eric and I started this, we wanted to have this high return on adventure was what we talked about. And that's what we're trying to do for our community is create value. I think we've gotten so far away from creating value. We're always focused on extracting value. I mean, people come to our website all the time and are working on different projects and get a bunch of information and download the plans or the electronics or the code and go off and do their own thing. And that's great. You know, we're not just extracting value, which
okay,
is what
I think I get it. So you, they like your mission. They like that they're getting the value and they think it's really cool and they really want to be part of it. That's what it sounds like. There's some other companies I think who do that too. They let website visitors contribute to different designs that they're working on. And so I think that's fine. That's the really profound thing, something that we could all learn from. And I quick about Tech Shop, do they also have people working on sustainable materials, like environmentally and healthy sustainable materials?
So this is a great question. I've long said, you know, from, you know, almost a year now that the maker movement needs more people who are interested in alternative materials. I think there's a big opportunity there.
Anyway, thank you very much for the call. You know, now it's feeling like, you know, where the caller was addressing the volunteerism thing. Even people who are very capitalistically oriented do volunteer work. You know, they spend some of their time. I mean, I like writing Amazon reviews.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things to do for fun. I'm not getting any money for it at all.
Yeah.
It's purely part of my volunteer effort.
Sure.
So is a way to make sense out of all of the volunteer time that people are doing is they're volunteering time for things they think are cool. And, you know, they're going to make their living some other way because you're not right now, you know, some are success stories. But if I put in a room, everybody who attended a maker tech shop or created something, the percentage of them who have made a sustainable living for all that time and effort is probably pretty damn small.
I don't know, actually. I think if you look
at... If I put 1,000 people who have visited a tech shop at least once, what percentage of them have made at least $10 an hour for all the time they put in?
Well, the problem there is that who's visited it once. The people who show up and spend a month or 2 months or consistently, who stick with it, because this is about sticking with it, usually find either... we're hiring people. I've hired people who I've met at tech shop. You know, it's more complex. And some people still, you know, teach a class at tech shop and then, you know, come and work for another maker company. And then they also have their own project that they're working that they're trying to launch on Kickstarter. I think the important thing here is separating work from jobs. And there's lots of work to do.
Okay, let's play with that. So I stand corrected. Let's say somebody who has spent at least 3 months staying focused on this and they've made the multiple income streams, not a job, it's work. What percentage of people who have decided to spend months involved in the maker movement in one form or another are making a sustainable living from that? If I had filled a room with 100 of such people, what percentage of those are making a sustainable living from that work?
You know, that's a good question. A significant percentage to the point where it's way better than anything else I'm seeing in the rest of the economy.
Cool. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco, David Lang. It's your turn on the air. What's your question for him or comment?
This strikes me as just maker, and this is not a criticism, that it's a new word for the old-fashioned inventor. And throughout the 20th century, there were all kind of inventors and tinkering with everything from toasters to, robots and things. You know, it was the old inventor, and can you invent something? And there was a whole movement even in the late part of the 18th century with inventors. But here's my question I've had for 15 years. I had a landlady who's 95 years old and had to spend $4,000 for a so-called low vision machine. So what it basically allows you to do is slide a book under it, and it blows it up on a screen, a computer screen, a monitor, and you can read it. But all it is, really, is a camera and a monitor. And think of all the millions of discarded video cameras. All it needs is a still camera. It's not recording anything. It's not taking motion. You just need a still camera to aim at the reading material, and then a monitor to display it on, larger. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a grant-funded movement or something, especially as seniors get older, to just collect these things and repurpose them as reading machines and make it something as convenient or as portable as possible. But it's not new technology. It's just taking old discarded crap and making it a lot more affordable for people of limited means.
Thanks for the call. There are two separate questions he raised.
I'm going to do the second one first.
Right.
So I get these emails and calls all the time now. David, I got this idea. I want to make this. And my answer is the same for every one of these things. Go make it.
Right.
Go try it. You'll learn something, and then keep going.
Yeah.
And then the first one,
we addressed earlier, which is the question is how is the maker movement different from the standard inventor? Why don't you repeat it for those who are later joining us?
Yeah. So the idea is that this is the maker movement sounds like something that's been going on for a long time. Absolutely. Dale Doherty, the founder of Make, says this is a tradition. We're humans. It's very natural that we want to create things. We want to make stuff. We want to make our world better. But I think the difference here is the internet. It's just amplified what's possible in these new digital fabrication tools. Obviously, I want to tell you something interesting.
Good.
So I had ran a Kickstarter project for this book.
Right. That's fundraising for those. It's crowdsourcing fundraising. Go ahead.
Right. Right. It's also a great way to build a community of people. The money goes away, but the community keeps
going.
Good
point.
So anyways, I sent out a survey to all these people. I said, what do you want to make? I was really curious. Who are these 2,500 people who backed this book? And some things surprised me. One is that there's about a third of them were people who just wanted to learn more about these tools, were really unfamiliar with it, kind of my position. A third of them wanted to build a maker space or wanted to build some part of this maker infrastructure. And then the other third was, I've been a woodworker for 30 years. I've been a welder for 20 years,
right.
And I just don't understand what's going on.
Good.
And I think there's a big opportunity to take those people who have a lot of skills, a lot of real skills, and then mix that with this, I guess, a younger generation who's very, very good at sharing and very fluent with these kind of digital tools and figuring out a way to work together. I haven't really put my finger on it, but I think there's a big opportunity of marrying those two groups. And it's got to be about creating value instead of just figuring out ways to extract it.
Well, you've certainly added value to Work with Marty Nimco this Sunday. My guest has been David Lang. He is the author of Zero to Maker, Learn Just Enough to Make Just About Anything. He's also the creator of are these underwater robots, are they available for sale? Who would buy one of these things if they are available for sale?
So, yeah, they are for sale, openrov.com, and that we sell kits. So we sell the parts that people use to put them together. And I think that's a really important aspect, is because we're kind of training this new genre, this new class of DIY ocean explorer.
Yeah. What's the application for it? Who would want to buy one of these things?
Oh, my gosh. That's a topic of a whole other show.
Okay.
But it's everyone from fishermen to conservation groups, to hobbyists, people in aquaculture, just to boaters to scuba divers. We're finding new uses, you know, just about every day.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again for being my guest on Work with Martin and with David Lang. It's been fun.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. Okay. You know, I two things I want to do in the 15 minutes or 13 minutes we have left. I want to invite you to call if you want a 3-minute workover. If you are stuck, you or someone you love is stuck with your career problem, you're unemployed, unhappily employed, filthy rich, but not really, we don't have to say filthy rich, you're rich, but you're still feeling empty. Whatever your career problem, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I won't take any more calls on the Maker Movement, so let's put that aside. I want to, while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, I want to give a little quiz. I was talking to David before, and I gave him a number of topics that I could do, you know, little quizzes on. And this one he said he wanted was me to do one on time management. So I figured, okay, what the hell, let me do that. I mean, everybody knows they should manage their time well, but not everybody does. How about you? I want you to rate yourself on each of these items. Rate yourself from 0 to 10. Number one, worldview. 10 would be that you realize that time is your most valuable possession and you're careful to use it wisely. 0 would mean that you rarely think about time as a valuable possession. Score yourself on that. Write it down. Take out a piece of paper. Write it down. Grade yourself from 0 to 10 on, you know, how whether you think time is your most valuable possession or not. Second question, I think I've got about, how many do I have here? I've got 10 questions, so maximum score will be 100. 2, time consciousness. 10 would be that in and outside of work, you're usually thinking, is this a good use of my time? 0 would mean at the end of the day, you're always wondering where the time went and you note how little you got done. So how time conscious are you? I'll repeat it again. And 10 points would be in and outside of work, you're usually thinking, is this a good use of my time? 0 would be at the end of the day, you're always wondering, where the heck did the time go? And you're noting how little you got done. Third one, I call this one prioritization. 10 points would be you have a clear sense of what's important to your career and to you personally, and you prioritize your time accordingly. You maybe even have a personal mission statement. 0 would mean you're unclear, you have no idea of your priorities, you just kind of do whatever's in front of you at the time. So rate yourself from 0 to 10 on that. And I'll go halfway through this, and I'll take some calls because the calls are coming in. The fourth one is I call time effectiveness. 10 would be you're always asking yourself, not is this the fastest way to do something, but is it the most time-effective approach, the approach that's going to yield the most benefit for the time expended? Like, for example, in preparing that report, how much research should I do? Not too much, not too little, just right, like Goldilocks. So a 10-pointer is you're always thinking, you know, what is the right level of detail to do each project? 0, you'd score, you know, you almost never think about whether your approach to tasks is time effective, you just do them. Question number 5 on this, how well do you manage your time quiz? How time effective are you outside of work? 10 would be that you're consciously assessing the wisdom of spending time on such time-consuming activities as golf, cooking complicated meals, watching TV, playing video games, going to maker fairs when you know that really it's only going to be just a hobby, and, you know, taking distant camping trips or going to your cousin's third wedding in Oshkosh, you know, so 10 is you're consciously assessing the wisdom of spending time on stuff like that side of, out of work. 0 would be you never think about the time effectiveness of such activities. We'll do the second half of the quiz in a moment, but let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, it's you. Hi, are you there? Okay, let's go to the next line. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hey, Marty, how are you? My name's Joseph. I love your show. I've been listening to you for a long time. I always learn something new.
Thank you, Joseph. Let me see if I can teach you something this time.
I'm a very happily retired special education and mental health worker.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to caution you, the term retarded.
I knew you were going to go there. That's the ultimate. You know, lower your amplitude on that.
You know, challenged or
developmentally disabled, challenged. You know, I think that's what gives well-meaning people a bad name. If we get too obsessed with, like, differences like that, not good. You may learn a lot from me. And if I invite you to learn something else, have a sense of perspective on what's important. I did write an article once where I used the word retarded, and there was a woman who was a parent of a developmentally disabled child who was mortally offended, and she sent her 4,000-member list. You know, he used this antiquated, degrading term. I invite you to have perspective on what is and isn't important and the different. Yeah, so he's going to hang up on me. You know what? My job is to serve the larger need, not that caller. I'm well aware that the right term, I wasn't calling anybody retarded. I said I was retarded at fixing anything. It is an absolute fact that I am retarded at fixing something. And so get over it. At the risk of some having some people call me insensitive. Let's, I think I'm going to take, we only have about 8 minutes. I'm going to give the rest of these items on the how well do you manage your time quiz. Number six, 10 points would be you delegate tasks when your time would otherwise be better spent. For example, you may have recruited an intern to work for you, even though he or she may not do all the tasks that you can do as well as you could have done them. Maybe you hired a part-time personal assistant to maybe do errands, laundry, housekeeping. So how well do you give yourself 10 points if you delegate as appropriate? Zero, you rarely delegate, even if it makes sense to. Question seven on the time management quiz, flexibility of approach to tasks. 10 point would be, as like when you're driving a car, you consciously decide the appropriate speed for doing a task. For example, on an important, difficult task, you consciously slow down and you work carefully. On a task that isn't that important, you kind of just race through it. Like some reading materials you had to read for school. You know, you don't necessarily read all that massive reading list with scrupulous care. 0 points would mean you never think about how quickly or carefully a task needs to be done. You just do it. Number eight on the time management quiz, you know when to stop struggling. 10 points would be you consciously and with reasonable accuracy decide when additional struggle is too unlikely to be time effective. So you get help when you need to, or you decide you can complete the task without conquering that roadblock. So that's 10 points here. You know when to stop struggling. It's a silly idea that you just keep struggling all the time. You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. 0 points would mean that even if you feel additional struggle is quite unlikely to help, you continue to struggle with it on your own, or you give up when you should be asking for help. So really, I find that people who just continue to persist and struggle ultimately end up getting much less done, not just because they're spending the time struggling, but because they make the task so odious that they procrastinate doing the entire thing. So that's a key thing, to know when to stop struggling. I'm going to give out the phone number one more time. If you or someone you love has a career-related problem, maybe it's a problem with your boss, it's a problem with a coworker, you don't have a job, you're 50 years old and you still don't know what you want to be when you grow up, any kind of work-related problem, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, I can usually help you take at least a baby step forward. The phone number for a three-minute workover here on Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The ninth question on the How to Manage Your Time quiz is making the most of what I call dead time. 10 points would be that you usually have an activity handy to sponge up dead time. When you're on a commute train, when you wait in the doctor's office, like, for example, you might bring a problem to think about or an article, a professional article to read. That would be 10 points. You make the most of dead time. 0 is that you always veg out during dead time. And so score yourself on whether you make the most of dead time, 0 to 10. And the final question on the time management quiz is regarding growth. 10 points would be that you're trying to better manage your time, that you're trying to improve. So, for example, you might ask somebody who is very time efficient for suggestions, maybe even to watch you at work for an hour and see where you're not being efficient, or perhaps keeping a log for a week on how you actually spend your time, or simply taking to heart this little quiz's results. That would be 10 points, that you're really committed to and involved in growth and getting better at time management. And 0 means you're not really trying to improve at all. And so now I'll briefly go over the items very quickly and see how you score from 0 to 10 on each of them. Number one, do you score yourself 0 to 10? Do you realize time's your most valuable possession? 2, yourself 0 to 10 on time consciousness. In and outside of work, you're usually thinking, is this a good use of my time? Rate yourself 0 to 10. 3, prioritization. 10 would be you have a clear sense of what's important to your career and to you personally, and you prioritize your time accordingly. 0 to 10. 4, time effectiveness at work. You're always asking yourself, not is this the fastest or the best way to do it, but the most time effective way, 0 to 10. Number 5, time effectiveness outside of work. You're consciously assessing the wisdom of spending time on such time-consuming activities as golf, cooking complicated meals, all that kind of stuff. Score yourself 0 to 10. Number 6, delegation. You delegate when your time would be otherwise better spent. 0, you never delegate even when it's appropriate to. Number 7, flexibility on your approach to task, which is as when you're driving a car, you're deciding the appropriate speed for doing a task. You don't do every task the same speed. 0 to 10. 8, you know when to stop struggling. Your 10 points would be you're consciously deciding with reasonable accuracy when additional struggles would be unlikely to be worth the time. Score yourself 0 to 10. Number 9, you make the most of dead time. You have a sponge activity to sponge up time that's otherwise wasted on a commute train. Now, it doesn't have to be 100% of the time, but sometimes you do want to veg out, but most of the time you're aware of that dead time. And number 10, growth. You're trying to better manage your time, 0 to 10. And now score yourself from 0 to 100, and more importantly than your score, ask yourself, in light of this quiz, is there one thing that you want to do differently to make more of your time now? And that is that. We've got just about 2 minutes, and so what I want to do is I simply want to offer a couple of tips. I always keep a collection of ideas that I wanted to share with you, and so let me do that. When you're having a meeting, the natural tendency is to sit when you're having a meeting. But I want you to consider having a meeting, especially if it's two or three people, to have a meeting while you're walking. That boosts how relaxed you are. It boosts your circulation, which therefore increases the brain flow, your brain, and you therefore have more good ideas, more likely to flow. So consider having two or three person meetings while walking. Completely random other idea that popped into my head recently or heard about. There is a wonderful under-the-radar medical career. Everybody talks about healthcare careers, but there's one that I'd never heard of, and it's called intraoperative neuromonitorist. This person tests neurological function during surgery. And that's always one of the dominant themes in this show. I'm always encouraging people to go under the radar. Everybody knows about doctor, nurse, lawyer, teacher, whatever, but there are thousands of under-the-radar careers, and this is merely one to trigger your thoughts. Intraoperative neuromonitorist. Google it. People are always talking about how to improve their communication, how to stop being so long-winded, how to stop procrastinating. In the end, while this is very difficult to do, it really does come down to vigilance. I would love to lose 20 pounds, but I keep forgetting in the moment of truth when that food is there, I don't just stop eating when I'm no longer full. I keep eating. Vigilance is not easy, but it is often extremely key to changing any habit. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I'll talk with Phyllis Kaplan. She'll talk about employing the so-called unemployable. She's helped people with significant physical and mental disabilities to find employment. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.